Welcome to another episode of Morelia Python Radio. Real quick, let's give a bit of a backstory on why I'm so excited about this episode. We first met Gavin on our 2019 trip to the Northern Territory. He didn't know us and probably thought, oh man, I have to meet up with a bunch of these yokels. Luckily for us, we were able to find an Owen Pelly before meeting with him. That way, we at least had a little bit of credibility. He not only talked to us at dinner, but then he took us herping and we found a Darwin carpet python. By the way, the picture's on page 141 of the More Complete Carpet Python book. He also showed us a juvenile Owen Pelly python, and man, was that amazing to be able to actually have hands on such a rare species. Well, since then, we've been trying to line up a show with Gavin so that we could talk about this journey that he's had with this species. Originally, we were supposed to do a student in the serpent about the Owen Pelly python, but Darren Boswell reached out to me, and then he asked maybe have Gavin come on. And I figured once Gavin agreed that he had the time to do it, I am not doing a student of the serpent episode. We are going to talk to Gavin and just be about Gavin and his whole dedication to this species. I mean, he's been doing this for 20 years. And it was just an honor to talk to him and have him come on and teach people about his journey with the species and you know, helping people even know that this python exists. I mean, really, most people don't, except for the python nerds. You know who you are. Shout out to Rob Stone and Keith McPeak for coming on with us. I felt like we were back at the bar by Croc Cove again. This was awesome. We bring you episode 554. All right. Here we are, episode number 554, and we finally have Mr. Gavin Bedford here. I'm so excited to talk to you about Owen Pellies, pythons. I think, would you say, Owen and Rob, would you say that I find that the Owen Pelly python is one of those pythons that the people in the U.S. are like, you know, like the Morelia nerds, like our crowd, they know what it is. But like when you tell them Owen Pelly python, they're like, what? Look at this. Check this out. Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Yeah. You're also dealing with people who I at the show the other day, I had to explain that an olive python is not an odd colored Burmese. So there was that you are also dealing with that on the other hand. So it's almost like enough. Some of them, I'm like, you don't deserve an Owen Pelly. Get out of here. So, but yeah, they've been churning in my brain since we, saw them and we have all that, but well before then as well. So
yeah. So welcome, Gavin.
I was just going to say, it's not just the average punter out there that doesn't know what an Owen Pelly python is or an olive python. I had a very prominent person from the US, and we won't name names, Jay. But basically, he didn't know what an Owen Pelly was either. I was managing Crocodiles Park at the time, and he came in and I said, "Oh, you know, I've got some Owen Pelly pythons." He went, "Care? What was that?" Never heard of it, mate. See you later.
Okay, okay, bye. Like, all right, yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's wow.
But the flip side of that is, and to, you know, to Jay's amazement, I didn't know who he was either. So, you know, it's six of one, half dozen the other.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? It's
probably better
than the planet. Yep.
So I guess the first question for me, Gavin, is how did you get involved with the Owen Pelly python to where you are today?
Yeah.
Well, if we go back 20 years, I was a research scientist at the uni up here, Charles Darwin Uni, which at the time was Northern Territory Uni, which before was University College of the Northern Territory or Northern Territory Uni. Anyway, I was at one of the four universities I just spoke about, and they're all the same thing, but I was working on pythons then, so python ecophysiology, and my PhD was on ecophysiology of five species of python, which is now four because children's pythons and Stimson's pythons have been found to be the same thing. So this gets convoluted, doesn't it?
You know, it's fair. We're used to it rolling.
Am I going too fast? Or, you know,
Paxton changes like every week. It's fine. It's just
I swear to God, it depends what pair of undies they're wearing that day. You know, I'm wearing the pink ones with the with the blue polka dots, I think I'll change the name of children.
All the Mantaresia is together. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Absolutely. So anyway, working on ecophysiology of the five species of pythons, so there was water pythons, children's pythons, and carpets in the top end. And you guys and I found a carpet up here at one of my study sites, which was good. Mm-hmm. And then Bredeli and Stimos, which are now southern children's pythons down in Alice Springs. And so my background sort of and, you know, I did a master's on python physiology. So my background sort of lends itself to looking at things that I'm passionate about and really worried about. And you know, the story gets really involved, but in the nuts and bolts of it is we are losing so much habitat. And it's, and you know, you only got to fly from America to Australia and look down from 30,000 feet and you see just cities at night, farmland. There's just the, you know, the amount of pristine country is becoming less and less. And therefore, and coupled with that is DNA technology is getting better. And what we're finding is that some of the cryptic species that were a single species 20 years ago are now seven species or 15 species, depending on, you know, which sort of genus you're looking at. And so mm-hmm. it stands to reason that if the habitat's getting smaller and the number of species is increasing and they're, you know, parapatric, so they're found in different spots, we're actually losing species before we've even named them. So we're naming them after they've become extinct. And one of the ways to draw attention to what we're losing was to put this pelypython into captivity, because a lot of people had tried and failed. And they failed for a whole heap of different reasons. You know, the Territory Wildlife Park up here, which is 80 kilometres south of Darwin, had five animals at one stage. They even collected all five animals were ex Peter Krause animals or confiscations or whatever, and they were all female. And you know, when you're with a government institution, and I'm not trying to bash them at all, they just have a job to do, mm-hmm. and that's their job. Mm-hmm. But you know, all you guys that are on this really Python Radio are passionate about reptiles. It's a different thing. Yes, you might go into a job because you're passionate about it, but it's still just a job. But right. when it's your life, when it's your life and you can see something going downhill, if you don't yeah. do something about it, well, you've only got yourself to blame. And with the background I had in terms of my education, my keeping ability, such that it is, don't go there, but also my research background allowed me to say, look, I have the skills to bring this thing into captivity because I don't know what's going on with it. Parks and Wildlife don't know what's going on with it. The general wider community don't know what's going on with it. And more importantly, the traditional owners don't know what's going on with it. And it's only found on Aboriginal land. You cannot mm-hmm. say, oh, look, this farmer had it, because there are no farms where this thing is found. So the only way you can get it is to work with the traditional owners, which is where I started after a bit of a couple of false starts. And it turns out that they wanted to know what was going on with it too, because they'd seen dead children's pythons on the road and dead King Browns and a whole heap of other, you know, dead floodplain mm-hmm. goannas, Varanus panoptes, when cane toads came through. And the stench of death was palpable. You know, it was really frightening when cane toads came through, because you've got this wave of very toxic cane toads that only has to meet some sort of predator that mm-hmm. eats it, and it's dead. And the wave of toads doesn't get smaller. What happens is the number of predators that can eat the toad gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So it stands to reason that maybe if pelis eat toads, they're in a lot of trouble too, because we've seen olive pythons eat them, children's pythons eat them, carpet pythons eat them, blackheads eat them. You know, the list goes on. Yeah. And what we've found, and I was working for Shine, Professor Shine, a few years ago, looking at the incidence of snakes, you know, snakes in the top end eating toads. And I found that of the 20 species that I looked at, actually it might have been 19 species that I looked at, there were two that really didn't eat toads per se, and one was too small to eat toads anyway. You know, there's a little thing about this big. So and the one that ate 100% of the time was king browns. So the big king browns, which got to almost 3 meters and, you know, big girth like that, if they came across a toad, they ate it. So they're essentially 100% going to go, and that seems to be pretty much the case. There's one or two seen every now and again. And then the rest is a bell curve. So some carpet pythons would eat them, some wouldn't. Some water pythons from some areas wouldn't eat any frogs. Others from other areas eat every frog, so they'd eat toads. So essentially they'd die. So we just didn't know what was happening with Ompelis, and it seemed like no one really cared. You know, Parks and Wildlife, or parks authorities, have got their job to do, and their job description says we are here to conserve the wildlife, you know, plants and animals.
Right.
How they do it is determined by what their policies and procedures are. And so when you say, but what's happening with Ompelli pythons, they go, not enough data. Don't know. Oh, yeah, we better get to that. We'll look at that.
Somebody better do something about that, but whatever.
Exactly, Owen.
Yeah.
And so there was no imperative to do it. So I took it on myself that with my background, I've got to do something. So that's where it started. I went and saw the traditional owners. Actually, first off, I did as the forms say. The form says, please write to Parks and Wildlife and tell us what you want to do. So I wrote to them, and it was about a 20-pager, and I said, I'd like to collect some Ompelli pythons because we don't know what's going on with them. Denied.
Rejected. Yeah.
So then the next one said, go to Parks Australia because they're found on Indigenous land. Go to Parks Australia. So same deal, 20-pager to Parks Australia. And they said, so which group of Aboriginal people are you supposed to are you going to be working with? And I said, your form says come to us first. So I'm sort of doing that.
Yeah.
It became this endless loop.
Okay.
This circle of death in a downward spiral because I went to them and they – denied, you cannot do it because you're not working with anyone and you don't, you know, we just don't want you to do it.
Right.
So then a mate of mine, a guy called Greg Miles, who was a park ranger in Kakadu for 35 years, said, yeah, have you got it round the wrong way? You got it round the wrong way. If the traditional owners want it to happen, it will happen. It is almost by decree. And luckily, I went to a couple of different groups, a guy called Freddie Hunter and the Hunter clan from the top of the East Alligator. And Freddie said, well, I don't know. And he was a park ranger. He worked in helicopters culling ferals. And he said, yeah, I don't know what's going on in my country. I haven't seen one. You know, I haven't seen one for forever. And I said, well, do you mind if I collect a few from your country? He said, sure. Yeah, no worries. Yeah, we'll back you. And then a lady called Yvonne Gumadal from Gumbalanya, Ompelli, said, I'm happy to help too. I'm in. And so when I had their backing, it was almost like rubber stamped. You could almost see the fear in the eyes of the authorities as they were going, oh, my God, he's got to go and get him. Yeah, stamp, let's go. How can we help you? It shouldn't be like that. It really shouldn't. And you know some of the loopholes that I used to get through there, they've closed. So this was a once in a lifetime project. It will never happen again. But the traditional owners still back me. They still love the fact that I tell them what's going on every step of the way, and they need to know because it's their animal. It's their rainbow serpent. They revere this animal. Mind you, some groups eat it, but you know that's by the by. So you start thinking, if they wanted to know something about it, they must know this animal.
Mm.
When I found the first one called Esther, who, by the way, used to try and bite, which is really atypical of our bellies, maybe she just didn't like me. we found when I took the first Esther to Mowali Centre, which is the Aboriginal Rangers or the Ranger Centre in Kakadu, and I pulled her out of a bag. There were 42 Indigenous rangers there. Guess how many had actually seen an Ompelli?
I'm going to take a shot and say one.
None.
No, you're right.
Zero.
There was one. Yeah, that's right. If this guy hadn't turned up that day, it would have been zero. But, yeah, of the 42 rangers that were there, there was one that had – yeah, and he actually had a pet on Pelly. So he knew what they were.
That's almost cheating.
Pretty much. But that shows how infrequently they're seen. So in all of the clan groups in Arnhem Land and Kakadu, and there's about 30 of them, this is known as Naren, and that's why I've called it Naren. You know, you can see it in the background. Naren is where I go with, because I think that essentially supports them having supported me. Let's you know, Pelly's just a place. Naren's actually the rainbow serpent, and I think it adds a lot more, you know, weight and veracity to what we're talking about when you can call it by its indigenous name. And we're supporting Indigenous people to be able to do it. And you know, the beauty of how I did go about it with these Indigenous people is if I asked for anything now, they'd say, when do you want to get it? You know, and that's built on trust. Yes, I had to pay an awful lot of money for these animals, and the project is ongoing, but I stay in contact with them. They like what I do and they support it and I support them. So, you know, we've just got to do that. And I'd say not just in Australia, in Arnhem Land, but all around the world when we're dealing with Indigenous people that are prepared to support, you know, us with reptiles, we support them. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that.
Cool. How long did it take you to find the actual first snakes?
About 4 years. And
jeez. 4 years.
Have you guys heard of a guy called Peter Krause?
Yeah.
I thought you might have. Peter was one of the founders, and the guy, and you'll see in the book. Hang on, just talk amongst yourselves for a second. You'll see in the book there. I don't know if you can see that, but basically, I've dedicated you know this book to Peter Krause and Gunther Schmieder. I don't know if you remember Gunther. Both of those guys were instrumental in fathering amateur herpetology in Australia, and some of the techniques that Peter developed we still use. We don't recognize him and say, oh, you know, Peter did this with the substrate for incubating mediums and stuff like that. But essentially, he's the one that really played with it in Australia and made it work. So, I've tried to dedicate the book to the two essential last generation gods of amateur herpetology, and you know the keyboard warriors and the kids these days, they take it for granted. Because they didn't see that evolution from
100%
killing everything we had in captivity, trying to breed it, to now, if it isn't captive bred, well, you're an idiot, mate. You know, that sort of mentality.
Yeah, with their rack systems and their computers that run the whole everything. Yeah,
absolutely. So the first Peter Krause said to me. After about 2 years of looking, stop looking. They will find you. And of course, me being a scientist, I work on logic. And I went, well, how the hell can an arm belly find me? What's it going to pack up a suitcase and come down the Arnhem Highway to say, hi, Gav, I'm here, put me in a box? but essentially, that's what happened. I went into the north of the East Alligator, the upper reaches of the East Alligator with Freddie Hunter and then Peter Harlow and then Gordo from Gumbalanya, who was a teacher there, and we stumbled on the first one while we were sort of just having a cup of coffee, and I went, oh, that looks like a stick, Gordo, and he goes, no, I think it's a snake. I went, oh, I'll go and have a look. So I walked about 30 metres, and he was right. It was a snake, and it was the one we're after. So that was pretty handy. So essentially that one found us. And then over the next couple of years, Indigenous people would ring up and say, hey, I got this snake in a bag for you. And I go, oh, that's great. Who are you and where are you? And do I need to get into a plane to come and find you? And that was what happened for the next five. You know, the best story was Gordo had found the little one, which was a hatchling male. And he had it in a bag for me. And he said, "Oh, Gav, can you come out to Goombalanya and pick it up? Because I'm teaching all week and I can't get into town." And so it's a 3-hour trip out there. So out I go. And he's got two bags for me, and one's like a little teeny-weeny bag, and the other one's a big wheat bag, uh-huh. And it's got a massive, I'm telling you, it's 4.5 meters. And I went, "I thought you said you only had one for me." He goes, "Yeah, but last night I got rung up by the ladies from the club, that's all Indigenous ladies, and they'd been on their way to Jabiru, which is about 30 kilometers away, and they had to come from Goombalanya, cross the East Alligator Crossing at Cales Crossing, which is sort of mostly underwater. And as they've been heading towards Cales Crossing from Goombalanya, there's 4.5 meters of Ompelli python across the road."
Wow.
And they've gone.
How cool.
That's crazy. Weird.
And there's 15 ladies in this Land Cruiser. It's not like it's sort of not loaded up. It is. And these 15 ladies are circling this snake so it can't get off the road, but they're not going near it. And one of them says, "You've got to come here. We've got this thing. This thing is for that bloke." And I'm going, "Oh, God, how did Gordo get off of this?" And so he jumps in his car and he gets out there. And sure enough, there's 15 ladies doing the laps of this snake. So it can't go anywhere. It's just completely confused. And so they're screaming at Gordo, come here, get this snake for this guy. You get this snake for this guy. And so Gordo just walks up. Picks it up and shoves it in the bag and goes, "Thank you very much, ladies."
Yeah, thank you, ladies. Yeah.
And I'm so grateful to them because they didn't have to do that. They could have just let it go. They could have done anything. But everybody knew that they were supporting a conservation project that really had outcomes, and we'll get to the outcomes at some later stage, but, it had outcomes that were real and they knew the benefits from it, even though it's a rare and endangered animal, and they've rarely ever seen them. So, all kudos to them. And so these animals kept finding me. And in the end, I had six, and I thought, well, I can't afford anymore because I'm bankrupted as it is. We'll stop with six. The only other thing that I did that really stirred the establishment, and anyone that knows me knows that I hate staring at people. It's the last thing I want to do. But I had a permit to get animals out of Arnhem Land, not Kakadu. Now, Kakadu is our pristine, prime, World Heritage-listed national park. Mm-hmm. And they know nothing about what's going on with Narum. In their interpretation centre, their headquarters, they've got a fiberglass model of a 5-metre Ompelli. And you ask them about that and they go, "Oh, we don't know. No, we know they're here, but we don't know much about them." There's a couple get sighted at Norlangi every year. There's a couple get sighted at other places in the park, but essentially we know nothing about it. And I said, "So don't you want to know something about it? Isn't it sort of important if you're going to be interpreting it? Why not know a little bit about it?" It's just too hard. So in my non-stirring way, I got a guy called Jono Nagy from the top end of the park, who was the son of Big Bill Nagy, who was Kakadu man, to support the project. Because when Jono was a little fella, he used to see Narum on his country all the time. You guys went to Ubia, didn't you?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And you climbed up the top?
Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know when you're at the top and you're looking over the floodplain and you can see that little blips on the about 8 k's away mm-hmm. of sandstone just out by itself, outliers.
Yep.
Well, that's his country. That's called Hawk Dreaming and Cannon Hill. And his outstation is at Hawk Dreaming. And he grew up seeing Narum. But see, most of that was rainforest back then. When he and his dad lived there was rainforest that butted up against that sandstone escarpment. And over the years, through CSIRO and Parks Australia saying, you've got to burn, you've got to burn. It gets imprinted into everybody's head that they've got to burn, and it's burnt all that rainforest. The rainforest doesn't exist anymore. So, of course, that interface between the big Alicyncarpia tonata, the rainforest tree, and the escarpment doesn't happen anymore. You've got the escarpment, but no rainforest. And Nara needs that interface between the escarpment, where it lives in the deep crevices, to come out and hunt for birds in the rainforest. If the rainforest isn't there, guess what happens? You get olive pythons come in. And why do I say that? Anyone that's kept an olive python knows that they're the garbage disposal center of the if you've got any old rat that hasn't been eaten by a green tree python or a goanna or something like that, you go, oh, here's my olive python. It'll eat it. Just give me my hand back.
Right? 110%. Yes.
So if we translate that to a wild olive python, they are a generalist. They live in many different habitat types, and they eat just about anything they come across, hence garbage disposal. When you deal with a specialist like an Oenopeli, which is living in a rainforest abutting escarpment country, and the rainforest is taken away, it becomes open savanna. So then a generalist can come in. So then it's a fight between a 5-meter Oenopeli and an did I touch anything?
Nope, you're good. No. You're good. Just got they got a picture thing to go with.
When you bring in the generalist that can outcompete the specialist, might hang on for 20, 30, 40 years, but any of its offspring get eaten by olive python. So, you know, what we see is death by a thousand cuts. Now, what I'm describing to you is from observation. I haven't put transmitters in Oenopelis. I'd love to do that, and I wish I was 30 years old again because I'd do it in a heartbeat. But I'm not. It needs someone to actually do that. And, and if you could do that, you would no doubt see exactly what I'm talking about. This generalist takes up more and more country as it becomes denuded of the big rainforest that's there. So Jono supported the project, and he was fantastic. He said, Gav, you name it, we'll make it happen. And I said, well, how do we get through Parks Australia to get a permit? And he goes, leave that to me. and the fear in the board's eyes, all the clans are equal.
Right.
But Jono is Kakadu man's son.
Okay.
And he gets to the board and he goes, I want it to happen. And they went, okay.
Okay.
So I ended up with a permit from Parks Australia to collect two Oenopeli pythons for commercial purposes from a World Heritage listed national park. Now, if that isn't a poke, is that a poke in
the right? Yeah, come on. That was, yeah. Now,
as I said to you, I couldn't afford anymore. I didn't need anymore. But I got something that says, we are worried about this animal. We've got the traditional owners of the park that are worried about this animal. So we need to do something that shows that we are engaged to make something happen. And I think that's the beauty of this project. It's not about how many Oenopelis I've produced. It's how have we garnered support for a project on an animal that they know nothing about.
Yeah.
Nothing. They know it's big. There's a couple. But they don't know whether it's in decline. And you know, you will have seen when you were here. There's like 95% of the top end gets burnt every year.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We did see that.
95%. We're talking millions of hectares gets burnt every year. Well, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to work out that if you burn 95% of the top end every year, you lose stuff.
Yeah.
You lose time. And animals. And, you know, there's some that can deal with fire, like frillnecks. They're very good at dealing with fire for a while. But as soon as you take out a number of its strategic trees, which have rough bark, and only smooth bark trees come through, frillies are gone too. Frillneck lizards, you know, they're essentially an icon at the top end. So there's lots of things that we're losing that science will pick up on. But science can only do so much if it's pointed in the right direction. And from what I've seen, especially at universities these days, they're all dealing with DNA. DNA is the way to go. DNA is the panacea to save all problems. Uh-huh. No, it's not. It's just a tool. And it's a tool that is used to work out different aspects of it. But in 15 years' time, or 20 years' time, when we're at the point of no return with a whole heap of species across the planet, it's field ecologists that are the ones that are in the highest demand. Really, they should be in the highest demand now, not in 20 years' time. But unfortunately, humans are slow learners. You know, it's a bit like Bart Simpson or the hamster, you know, which is we don't learn quickly, and therefore we wait until the last minute before we actually do something. And so the Oompeli project to me was something that we could do while there's still good numbers of them, even though I'm watching a decline in this interface between the rainforest tree and the escarpment. And so essentially that's what I've done. And part of that was to get public support for it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm garbage at that. I'm not a good speaker. I struggle to deal with groups of people in a meaningful way. You know, there's those charismatic people that just say, "Here, would you like snow, Mr. Eskimo?" And they go, "Oh, I haven't had any for a while." There's people like that we need to actually sell that sort of stuff,
right.
And we need the scientists to do the work. To work out how we protect and maintain the populations that we've got. So, yeah.
Awesome.
Where were we at? Did I answer?
No, yeah, I mean, I assume somewhere in there was the answer to something. Yeah.
I think the question was how hard were they to collect?
Yeah.
Actual collect.
Hard.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Hard.
It's easy. You put them right in the bag once you got them. Yeah. But how hard was it? I mean, attacking this as far as establishing them in captivity. I mean, was there certain things you trial and error, or did you just kind of go at it like treating them almost like any other python?
For 40 years, I've sounded like the complete weirdo. And if we go, you know, Keith and I will go back 40 years and remember that. You guys at the top, right?
No, you'd miss me. Yeah, sorry.
40 years ago.
I'm in that group.
If you kept reptiles, you were a weirdo.
Yeah.
So when I was under 10, I was keeping, you know, blue tongues and bearded dragons and turtles and stuff like that. So I was the weirdo at school. But I was the weirdo at school that spent all my time watching them. Instead of watching the TV, I was watching what my blue tongues and turtles and stuff were doing. And I worked out really early on that if I poked my dog in the eye, I never did, but if I did, the dog wouldn't come near me for a while and it would be pretty stressed because I'd poke this thing, this lovely little thing with a waggy tail in the eye.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, what did I do to deserve that? Yeah. Never did it, guys. But you know the theory. But with reptiles, you can't do that. You poke it in the eye and it just sits there looking at you. There's no thought.
Mm-hmm.
But what you do see is a retraction. And I worked out really early on. When I was probably 12, I worked out that the stress reaction in humans is the same as we see in other animals, but it's not demonstrated in the same way. You get a punch in the face, you go, "Well, I won't do that again." But with reptiles, it's really hard to see what stress is. And so for 40-odd years, I've been saying these are high-stress animals, and some of them deal with it better than others. Mm-hmm. But essentially what we're doing is stressing a wild animal and expecting it to act as we want it to act, not as, you know, it wants to react. And so I've sort of watched so many different animals deal, you know, get stressed and how they deal with it. And every one of them does it. And, you know, when I was working on animals putting transmitters in them and release them. So I did, I don't know, 60 or 70 pythons where I'd put radio transmitters in them and I'd let them go. Now, when the literature at the time and all the world class researchers on putting transmitters, inserting transmitters in animals, had said, we look at the ecology of the animal the day we release it. So we're marking its, heart rate, temperature, where it goes, what it does, as soon as we've inserted a transmitter. Guys, I don't know about you, but I've had a couple of wisdom teeth pulled out, and there's no way eating anything the next day. Any form of major surgery is a stress on humans. So why would you think the same thing in animals? And so I started going, well, okay, I'll insert transmitters in these things, and we'll work out how long it takes before the stress reaction of the major surgery backs down. Guess how long?
3 months.
2 weeks.
You're out there. It's somewhere between a month and 3 months.
Jesus.
Essentially, every animal that I put a transmitter in would go into a burrow, curl up, and wait for a month. Wouldn't do anything. Sometimes they'd be out moving because I'd put them in their home range and they didn't like where they were and things like that. And every animal that's got its own little mind map knows where its home range is and where its burrows are and tree branches and things like that that it uses. But essentially it would go into its burrow and curl up, go into a shed cycle, not feed, not do anything that I saw as normal behavior for at least a month. And yet everybody I spoke to would put a transmitter in and go, oh, Gav, you're wrong. No, we just put it in, see you later. Away we go. So am I hugely wrong? Probably. Who knows? I've never been known to be right. So let's get with these guys around the world not doing that. So what if I'm just a little bit right? What if I'm just a little bit right? Then all the data that they've got for at least the first month is a waste of time.
Right.
It's false. It's a false narrative.
Right.
So then we go to animals that we see in captivity, and Keith and I have spoken about this a little bit in the past. You will have all seen pythons that go ragdoll or bearded dragons that go ragdoll. They just lose all musculature. They don't fight back. They don't eat. They just go downhill and die.
Mm-hmm.
What's that from?
Stress.
It has to be. Yeah.
Absolutely. It is a stress reaction, but it's due to chronic handling, chronic something that's stressing it over such a long time that essentially like a POW, prisoner of war, they just give up. I've had my time. That's it. See you later. It is really hard, and I still sound like the weirdo 40 years later, saying stress in my mind is the biggest hurdle when you're bringing anything into captivity. That should be wild. And so these Naron were the same, but I was aware of it. So my whole modus operandi was hands off, let's let them go for as long as I possibly can to work out what I can do and what they should be doing without touching them. And so I think that got me off on the right foot. But, as you all know, there's a huge difference between what is a captive bred animal and a wild caught animal. It is short days. As it should be, it's not an easy thing to do. So my, the biggest girl that I got, who's 5 meters long, and she now weighs about 16 kilos. But when I had Brian Barczyk and his film crew with Peter Birch and a few others come over not long after I got her, and I was really, I was acutely aware that when you're filming, you want that shot. It's the money shot. We've got to have it. And I said to Brian, I've only just got her eating. I really don't want you to muck with her too much. No, mate. We'll just do it for a few minutes. And 4 hours later, I had to take her off him and put her into a cage. And I love Brian. I got on really well with him. He's a great guy, but his imperative was different to mine. Mine was to reduce the stress on the animal. His was to get the shot. It took me 3 months to get her eating again. It took her 3 months before she would stop retracting her head every time I walked into the shed. Now, I can do that with all the wild caught ones now. They don't retract. But if I brought any of you into that shed, they'll pull back they won't eat again for a while. And that's, I don't know what it is. They just know. I give them credit for more brains than most people do. I specifically call Naran the thinking person's python because I think that's what they are. They really are that level above. You know how we say taipans are the thinking person's a lapid?
Yeah.
Well, if you don't want to get killed, get the thinking person's python.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go. All right, yeah. I like that. I like that better. It seems safer. Yeah. Jeez.
Yeah, yeah.
With regards to the stress, what were there breakthrough moments where you felt like that the animal was settling down? Like, what was did you stay out of the room? What, like,
I reckon about 3 years, I worked out that the five that I had would tolerate me, and one of them wouldn't eat. You know, the second biggest girl, I was force feeding for 2 years. You know, and she would not touch anything. and the stupid idiot me decided that the day that she did grab a dead lorikeet that I'd been given, she grabbed a lorikeet, got it right down to the tail feathers, and I when you're dealing with hatchlings and you feed it, you just go into statue mode for about I did that with this thing, and it's 4.5 meters and it's maybe a meter away from me, but my phone was on the desk in front of me, so I'd stood still for about 3/4 of an hour and she'd got this lorikeet all the way down and all that was left was about this much of a tail feather, and I went, "You beauty, I'll get a photo of this," and I went snail pace down to pick up the phone, and I got the phone up to about here, and she went, "Bleh."
No.
Start again in another month. She wouldn't eat again wouldn't even look at food again for another month. Had to force feed her in between. So, Eric, you know, to answer your question, it took sort of 2 to 3 years, and then for some reason, most of them tolerated my presence. But I just couldn't bring anybody else into the shed. And even now, if I bring someone in there, they let me know about it. You know, they do react. Not eating.
That's interesting.
Was
a small one any easier than the big one? I mean, that's the general thought process, right, with wild pythons, is that the smaller they are, the more readily they'll adapt to captivity. Did you find that with sort of the range and size you saw?
When I got the small one eating, yes. Yeah, yeah. Until I worked out what he would eat, then no, it was still same deal. But probably not a stress reaction per se. Just a food preference. You know, I don't like it. I'm not going to eat it, sort of thing. Yeah. What I found was if it was a wild bird, they'd eat it. And we've got wild birds in Central Australia that are not native to there. So there's a men shed that traps these wild birds and just puts them in the freezer. And so I got a whole heap of that, which was fantastic because they're just a turtle dove, which is found down in Adelaide and Melbourne and stuff like that, but it doesn't belong in Alice Springs. And so they were getting me hundreds of these turtle doves and sending them up to me, and it worked perfectly. And then I'd do daisy chains with, you know, a turtle dove that they'd eat and put a rat behind it.
Right.
Keith's read some, you know, the old version of the manuscript where I talk about doing daisy chains, and this is where they become the thinking person's python, because they would eat the turtle dove, no dramas. And then they'd wrap a coil around the rat and pluck it off.
Oh, jeez.
They're twiddled up and they're going, "Yeah, suck in. Got you." And I did this a dozen times, and I thought, nah, they're not that smart. They're not that smart. So after a while I would do two turtle doves together and a rat. And sure enough, it'd get down to the rat and go, "Yeah, no, I don't like that," and pluck it off. And you start going, how the hell do they know that? How do they know that you got two turtle doves? I know. We'll try three turtle doves and a
Jesus
rat.
Christ.
Sure enough, they get to the rat and pluck it off. And it was deliberate. And it wasn't just one snake. There were a heap of them that would do it.
Wow.
All those wild caught ones would work it out. Actually, you know, Bob, the little boy, he would eat by himself pretty quickly. So, you know, he wasn't too bad. And I actually got him on the rats. But the others, they still eat quail. They, you know, I went from turtle doves onto quails, and they sort of go, oh, yeah, I don't really like quail. It smells domestic, but okay, I'll eat it. And then after a while,
it's a bird.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's it. So in the wild, they've just got to be bird eaters. Bird eaters. Excuse me, guys. I'm gonna die.
That's so funny. I'd pull my hair out. Yeah, like you were talking about earlier. Yeah, I'd pull my look what they did to me. All right, yeah, I got it.
Oh man.
Oh my god, that's great though.
Do you think in the wild that is there any evidence if they eat bats as well, or is it only bird stuff?
Well, Greg Miles, the ranger, senior district ranger, he had an Oompelli that he had for a while, and he reckons they just go absolutely nuts for fruit bats. So it wouldn't surprise. Yeah, but it's like everything. Once you're cued into something, that's your food. It's like you with I'm assuming you with McDonald's. You go yeah McDonald's, but then if you like McDonald's but you don't like Burger King, McDonald's is where you go.
Right.
Yeah.
If we a wild bird is McDonald's, and a captive bird is Burger King. Well, they're never going to Burger King. They're just eating at McDonald's.
Yeah, all right.
Right.
Yeah.
And essentially, that's what it is. Until you can, and the younger ones, I've been able to convince to eat rats and things like that. That's just normal tricks that us herpers use. That's no biggie, really. For me in Darwin, because it's so hot all the time, you just cannot get away from the heat. There's very few people that have rats. So I can get quail. I can't get rats. So I've got most of my animals on quail. I've got about a dozen that are on rats, and that's about it. Yeah, but all the big ones are on quails because it's so easy to say, here's your 2 kilos of quails, go and eat it, and they do. They're all dead, guys. They're all dead. It's not live.
It's fine. With the babies, the captive born babies, was there a more push towards bird there, or was it just any normal kind of baby python kind of a thing?
They're bird eaters, absolutely 100% bird eaters. So I've got a few from that I hatched out this year, and I can put rat pups in there. You know, they hatch out at a meter, so they're big enough to eat a fuzzy rat pretty easy. They choose not to. You know, if you put 2 quails and a fuzzy rat in there, the quail will be gone and the
rat will be there.
Yeah, that's right. So that when you're switching them over, it is a trick. Having said that, every now and again you get one that will eat a rat, and when you think about it, that's a great survival strategy in the wild. You know, I was talking about all those snakes that eat cane toads, but not all of each species eats a cane toad. You know, there's some that just don't cue in on frogs, so they survive. And again, that's that survival strategy. It's genetically linked, and there's some that will eat rats. So I tried, native rats, just some dead ones that I could get a hold of on some of the captive bred ones that I had, and they didn't see it as food. So, but again, it's horses for courses. If you're born in the escarpment and this rat turns up, do you say, No, I'm waiting for birds. All right, see you
later. Thank you. No, it's good. Thank you. Yeah.
You're Burger King. I'm going to wait.
Wait for McDonald's. Yeah.
So, rats in the escarpment? I don't remember if we had seen much evidence of that in the same way that we do, like in the Utah desert and stuff, looking in ledges and things like that. You'd see a ton of rodent feces and things. In the escarpment, I don't really remember that. Is there a density of rodents in the escarpment?
There was, and there is to some degree. And John Winowski, from the head of research at Parks, who was the head of research at Parks, essentially showed that there's been almost a catastrophic decline in small mammals in Kakadu and Arnhem Land. So we do know that Naran eat some mammals, you know, bandicoots, bats, as you said, and there's probably 20 different species of bat out there. I could be wrong. Might be 15, but yeah, there's an awful lot of different bats out there, from little micro bats right through to big fruit bats. Mm-hmm. And you know, Antichinus and different rock rats. There's a once upon a time there were quolls there. You know, big sort of cat sized marsupial. There's an awful lot of mammals there, and it stands. This is where I come back to think of the ecology of the area and just what's happening there. And as I mentioned, 95% of the top end gets burned, so that's a limiting factor. It opens it up to generalist predators like olive pythons, so that's a limiting factor. It allows cats to get into areas where they couldn't get. That's a limiting factor. And then if you see the decline in your prey, and it's been, and as John Wanowski said, it's a catastrophic decline. It's not just, oh, we've lost 10%. It's like we've lost 90%. So if 90% of your food source goes, there's a good chance that you're in a lot of trouble too.
You're next.
Population, yeah. There'll be some areas that are doing very well, and, you know, places around Melange seem to be doing quite well, as around Gumbalunya. But other areas that are getting burnt and other predators have come in and we don't know about, what's going on? Well, I don't know. That's why I'd love to put a student out there with transmitters on them and have them roam around a bit, you know. Have a good holiday.
Yeah, wander around. Yeah, it's fine. To tag some stuff. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, that would be really good fun for sure. I mean, it's great country, and they're so cool. It's one funny thing that, you know, and obviously you mentioned 4 years, but the funny thing to me has been in terms of folks like us that coming out to try and give it a go is that there's 3 nights seems to be the magic number. I know Jake Many had come up and they with the crew, and they went out 3 nights in a row, and then on that third night, and that was the case with us as well. I think it's a function of time, right? I mean, as a limiting factor for folks finding them for so long, it does seem like at a certain few places, if you just keep going, that you probably will find them. But it's just, as you say, it's if you're presenting yourself as being in the relative middle of nowhere, you know, those spots are 3.5 hours, 4 hours further from that, hey? So.
And I hate you all.
We get that a lot.
I spent thousands of hours, including hundreds of hours where you guys were.
Yep.
And if I could make a hand gesture, I would.
Where's his teeth with the magic eyesight, you know?
Yeah, thank God we brought him. Yeah.
One of the guys, is a great guy, and it's all said in jest as I did then, but one of the guys I just say I hate the most is a guy called Stuart McDonald, and Stuart's a great herper, and he's just got that naive arrogance at the time, or belief in his own abilities or whatever. And he came to me in Darwin, I think I was at the innie at the time, and he said, oh, I'm going to find a chameleon dragon and an Owen Pelly in the next 2 days. I went, yeah, good luck with that. He gets out to, you know, chameleon dragons. I've seen half a dozen, I reckon, in 35 years. And he gets out to Jabiroo, and he goes, oh, it's a bit hot. I'll go to the airport. And he's heading to the airport, which, as you know, is about 6 kilometres, might be 8 kilometres from Jabiroo. And he goes, oh, I just got to stop and have a drink. So he parks his car under a tree, and a chameleon dragon falls on his bonnet.
That's not fair.
You are kidding me. Anyway, he rings me up and he tells me this. You know, chameleon dragon fell on the bonnet. I go, yeah, you muggle. good luck with the Owen Pelly. Well, next night he's ringing me. It's not even dark. He's ringing me and he goes, I just walked into the car park and there's one curled up there.
Okay. What the hell? Some man, people I have all the luck, you know.
Absolutely, and to his credit, he's a good guy. So yeah, he's done well.
But don't buy a lottery ticket after that.
But again, it comes back to the fact that I wasn't that arrogant to think that I'd find him, and I didn't. So that's lucky. And B, like Peter Krause says, stop looking for him. You're just trying too hard. They know. Yeah. Just wait for them to come to you. So yeah. Anyway. And lots of people have done exactly what you did. You know, just, oh, look, there's one. What's that, mum?
The birders, right? That to that point, they're really not looking for them. The thing they're looking for
the birders aren't
going
finding
down
them.
The hatch.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. And you know, you start thinking, why do birders see them in trees? And they see them at a particular time of year in a tree. And my guess is they're always male. No one's pulled them down and sexed them, but my guess is they're always male. I saw it with, as I was telling you guys, when you're in Australia, carpet pythons that were living in houses and in trees knew when the females were in season. And they'd move through the trees to get to the girls. They'd never actually touch the ground. And I think that's what the boy ompellies are doing. You know, they're waiting for to smell the pheromones of the females to see when they're in season. And then they just go, there she is, off I go. For us, we go to the pub and say, oh, she looks all right. I wonder if she wants a drink.
Yeah.
They're a bit smarter, and it doesn't cost them as much as us.
Yeah.
100%.
Damn.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. It's kind of not off topic question, but what's your thoughts on the color change? What do you think's going on there? Like, why are they doing that? And do you have any theories as far as that goes with your experience with them?
Well, I could put it to peacocking in humans. You know, they want to look pretty for the girls, so they dress up. Or the boys, whichever.
Yeah.
I think there's something going on there. But a mate of mine came up and did some skin reflectance on them day, night, fed, unfed, male, female, small, large, and there doesn't seem to be a rhyme or reason to it. There's a general trend where at night they go lighter, but you know, I can open drawers with 50 snakes and probably 25 of them will still be dull. You know, it doesn't necessarily always hold. When they've eaten, sometimes they'll colour up and stay coloured for a few days until they've digested. Other times they won't. It's almost like the draw. And individual variation is just huge too. You know, some of the wild caught ones are amazingly vibrant. You know, mostly at night, sometimes during the day. Others don't change much at all. However, having said that, they all change. There's not one that doesn't change. It just varies individual, time, size, sex, whatever. Years ago, the beauty is that's a research subject for someone that's working on it, right?
Right.
And I think that's really important. And we all know about it. We know that roughies do too to some degree. So, you know, that's great. How does that relate to in the wild? Well, all of us theorizing in a captive situation, so who knows. Years ago I wrote a little paper that I thought would go absolutely nowhere, and it was on why Kalia skinks wag their tail. I don't know if you know Kalia's, you know, little skink.
Absolutely.
About this.
Yeah.
Erlangi's covered in them, hey?
So. Yeah.
Erlangi's covered in them. So,
That's right. Yeah, it is, and probably about five different species. And around in my garden here in Darwin, you know, I've probably got three different species of it, and they'll take about 20 steps, and then they'll sit there wiggling their tail. Now, if you're an animal that's trying to avoid a predator,
why you moving? Yeah,
as dumb as you can get, isn't it?
Yeah.
So why do they do it? Now, all of the Kalia species do it. There's not one that doesn't do it. And they run their little heart out for about, you know, a meter and then sit and wiggle their tail. So I was working on frill-necked lizards, and they had transmitters attached to them. So I was sitting sipping lattes under an umbrella out in the savannah, as you do in 40-degree heat. Sounds delightful, doesn't it? And listening to pings on my radio gear, watching these Kalias, and I'm going, well, why the hell are you doing that, you idiot? You know, you're just going to get attacked. But they didn't. And then I looked at how many had regrown tails, and it was pretty minimal, you know, so they hadn't been attacked in the tail. So it's almost like, well, they don't get attacked, and they waggled their tail. So what's it all about? So I wrote this little paper, and I put in Herpetofauna, that they do it because they're happy. That was my theory. They do it because they're happy. You know, a bit like a dog, you know, it's wagging its tail because it's happy. Yeah. Now we know that lizards don't get happy, they don't get sad, they don't have human emotions. So I just like the play on it, the irony of it, the thingy. And I put this little paper out and I thought not much of it because I could not come up with a solution as to why they wag their tail. It doesn't attract food. It doesn't repel predators. It does nothing. It just wags their tail. So they're just happy. About 10 years later, this girl came up to me at an ASH meeting, an Australian Society of Herps, and she said, "Thank you so much for that paper." I went, "Why?" She goes, "Well, when I was doing undergrad, I did a project on it, and then I finished undergrad and I did an honours degree on it, and I looked at a whole heap of different species, and I agree with you. They just do it because they're happy." So we come back to the Owen Pelly and the changing of the colour, and my theory on peacocking is probably as close as we're going to get because who knows? It might be just like this Carlia. They just do it because they're happy.
Right, because they want to. All right.
Absolutely. So that's a long way to get around. There might not be any correlation between why they do it and what's happening and what it does.
That's so nuts. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just one of those interesting things to me because it's like, yeah, I guess to your point with the skinks, it's like, you know, why? Why are they doing that? Like,
and if we go to bearded dragons, some of those really bright red bearded dragons you get around Cougapedia or whatever, it's temperature related. You know, once they start warming up, they get those amazing red colours with the big black beards on the boys, and it's just all that. But you see them at night, and they all look the same, black,
you know, right?
Dirty black. So that's pretty easy to figure out. And when they're coloured up with that big black beard, and they're sitting up high, looking at around, there's probably five or six girls that can see each boy, and they're going, "Aren't I pretty? Look at me, girls! Aren't I the best?" So, you know, it's pretty easy to figure stuff like that out. But when it's a color change in a python that really uses chemical cues to find partners and things like that, got no idea. Just looks good. Right.
Makes you flashy. I love it.
Yeah, sure.
So how was it producing them for the first time or in general, right? So once you were dealing with the fact that they're intelligent, and so you're having the stress response, getting over the stress response and that, what was sort of that next step in the process? What did that look like?
That took a while. Nothing ever is easy with these things from wild caught. If I had my time again, I probably wouldn't do it. If I knew now, I would help someone else do it to the end of the earth because we need to know. Mm. What would I do? Hell no.
Take a step back.
Absolutely. It's like getting in a cage with an MMA fighter and you can't beat your way out of a paper bag. What a hope to know. You know, so I wouldn't do it. But I spoke to Tracy Barker about, you know, how to go about it. And she said if you don't have good nutrition in them, if they're not of size, if there's not the stress reduction, then nothing's going to happen. So surprised the hell out of me when I got a clutch of eggs and didn't see mating, didn't see ovulation. And that's kind of really observant. She'd laid perfect. I was actually going away a lot of the time, so I just didn't have the time to watch it. But this was the big girl. She laid a clutch, I think it was 13 eggs, of which 11 were infertile. So there were two fertile ones. It was a really poor clutch. And that was a great moment of joy right up until I lifted her off the eggs and went, too light. And they turned out to be really poor hatchlings, so they didn't last very long, 6 months, I think, and then they just died. So that was a big kick in the head, as a lot of things have been. But then I think the next year I got two clutches, so she went again. I changed males with her, and she went again, and I got 15 eggs. So that was – and they were good, and I hatched a lot. And then I got the babies to eat after an awful lot of time. And so from that point, I knew the project would go, you know, but up until then, I was thinking, oh my God, I've spent almost $250,000 on this project and I haven't even got a baby, you know, nothing's going to happen. It's a real head knock.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got a couple of clutches that year. One was 15. I think the second one was 8. And they all hatched as well. I still got some from both of those clutches, and they're breeders now themselves. So that was kind of good. The youngsters are really interesting. You know, Peter Krause wrote about how long and skinny they are. That's a no-brainer. They come out of an egg that's 175 grams, 180 grams, which for an Australian python is the biggest python egg by a long way. You know, a black-headed python egg from memory, some of the big black-headed python eggs were a bit over 100 grams. I think scrubbies are about that too. But to have these things, you know, some of the eggs that I've got are over 200 grams. So, which, that's a big egg.
Yeah.
And
so you expect a big baby, which they are. They're hatched at a meter. But they've got so much yolk in them that they're almost the third yolk when they hatch. And they hatch late, which means that they have to go through the dry season, which is where there's little food, getting through to the next build-up when the biological rush of high humidity and some showers and things breeding happens.
Mm-hmm.
I think they survive 6 months without having to eat till the next season. That's why they've got so much yolk. Too bad if like this year I got a pair of twins, which are 50 grams each.
Jesus.
And no yolk, you know, so they're ready to eat straight away almost.
Yeah.
But mostly, yeah, that's a rarity, and they probably wouldn't survive in the wild anyway. But, you know, the animals that come out with, you know, a third of their body in yolk, and they just sit there, and they can take somewhere between a month and up to 8 months to even shed the first time. It's a freaky animal. It definitely is. It's very different any other python. And going back to when we first started, you know, you say, oh, you know, did you treat them the same as every other python? When you know enough about them after having them for a while, you know you can't treat them as every other python because they're not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, for sure. And it reminds me, right, the natural recognition on that, your experience on that first clutch that was mostly bad and then the babies were difficult, right? That's just like Peter's first clutch, right, or first or second, right, that was detailed in Ross and Mart, the reproductive husbandry of pythons and boas book, where, those beautiful photos. So did yours lay inverted like that? Because that photo is amazing, Peter's photo of it laying perfectly inverted.
Again, I hate Peter for that photo. it is the best photo I've ever seen, and I have tried every year to emulate that, and I can get them to sit inverted, but I just cannot get them to bring that head right round and sit down. So I've got some that are pretty close to that, but if it was a contest between Peter's one photo and my 50,000, Peter's wins every time. Frustrating. And you know, maybe that's part of where he had them. You know, he just got lucky with that one photo. I've got some that are pretty close, but, of course, she'll be pointing the wrong way. So she's in the nest box. The nest box opens back that way, you know, from the front to the back, and she's pointing at the back. So I can't get around and get anyway, that's life. And if that's the worst of my problems, I'll take it.
Yeah, but say that's I would do that too. I'd be like, oh damn it, I can't get the picture of the. Yeah, I would take that too.
Hey Gavin, I know you put cameras in to watch the animals too, so you don't disturb them too much. You've sent me some photos along the way. The one thing I wanted to ask you about, and kind of what you've showed me, is during ovulation and the building of the follicles. Even though it's a long, slender python, it's not that visually easy to see, right?
To see ovulation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, it's the biggest ovulation on the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jesus.
Can't miss it.
It looked like they ate a giant wallaby or something, right?
or a football or something. Yeah, it's just amazing. It's the most dramatic of any python I've ever seen. You know, when we had Snake Ranch, we were breeding every python in Australia except Baranoi and Ongeli. Every other python we had, and I've seen ovulations with everything else. And, you know, some olives will blow up a bit when they've got a big clutch, but it's nothing compared to Ongeli. It is just freaky. And you start thinking, well, how if you've got an animal that's 5 meters, let's say the average size that they breed at is 3.5 meters and 5 kilos, not 16. That's a fairly slim animal.
Mm-hmm.
That's a slim animal. So if it's having a clutch of 10 200-gram eggs, the ovulation on that has got to be huge, which it is. So now we step it down a bit, and guess what the weight of the smallest Ongeli that I've bred is? You can't answer, Keith, you know.
Not you, Keith. All right.
5 or 6 kilos.
That would have been my guess. I'm going to say 7.
2. Yeah. Oh, I was going to. Yep.
2 kilos.
2. Just wow. Okay.
180 grams. 180 Jeez. Grams. I'm sorry, 1.8 kilos.
Yeah. Okay.
She was 1.8 kilos, or almost 2 kilos. That's tiny. 4 pounds for you guys.
Wow. Yeah.
So when you think, that, you know, in the wild, the one that you guys saw, that would have been 4 kilos, 5 kilos, maybe. It was a big snake. So that's a breeding animal if it's a female.
Yeah.
And probably something half that weight was able to carry eggs, and she only had 3 eggs, so it's only a small clutch for a 2 kilo snake.
But right.
She was like that. The eggs are like that. So she's like that. And somehow she's got to ovulate as well.
Jesus.
So, I mean, wow. You're talking about something that's that thick going to something like that. You just go, oh, my God, how did that not pop?
That's why I was making a joke, because Gavin made a joke once. He sent me a picture of the female ovulating. He's like, what do you think? Like, are you kidding me?
It's a bit out
of Keith's not sure. What do you mean you're not sure?
Although sometimes, like olive pythons, I don't know if you've had the same experience, but olive pythons have a lot of phantom pregnancies or a lot of phantom ovulations where they're gravid, oh, damn, they're eating. Ongeli seem to do the same thing. And you know, you guys can probably answer this better than anybody else. In terms of Australian pythons, the Ongeli is the only one that I've ever seen multiples of lay infertile eggs. Have you guys seen lots of pythons lay infertile eggs? So they've never been with a male.
Mm-hmm.
They think that they're like chickens. They've laid eggs.
No.
Without even being with a male.
They've never been with a male, but they've laid eggs. So in my mind, every other python that I know about, and, you know, I probably haven't dealt with as many as you guys have, probably a few thousand, I've never seen it happen. And yet I know 3 instances up here. They're separate. One's in Darwin, one's in Adelaide, one's in the Australian Reptile Park, where they've actually been like battery hens and just laid eggs, shelled eggs that are infertile.
Wow.
And you just go, that's
crazy.
How does that happen in a python? Surely they're smart enough to reabsorb it. But
yeah,
maybe they don't think that much after all.
Well, I mean, we've all had slick clutches, but that's the male was in there and something happened somewhere in the breeding process to get the slick clutch. But to have never been in with a male and lay fully shelled clutches,
that's crazy.
No.
Yeah. And you know, the beauty of this thing is when they mate, man, they mate, they're connected obviously. For 24 hours. Okay. Right. You cannot miss it. If you miss it, it's infertile. It didn't happen, right? if they haven't waited for at least 12 hours, it didn't happen. It's a non-event. And so all these people that have got, you know, these shelled infertile eggs have had males with them, but they've never seen any sort of even romantic interlude. It's not mating. They haven't even bought the flowers and the wine. there's absolutely nothing there. So they know they've never mated.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And another wrench in the work. I mean, like, you know, why do they color change? Why do they do this? There's too many questions.
So, that just makes it a cool python.
Yeah, I know. A cool snake. Yeah. You know?
Well, it's kind of neat that there's so many questions that we need to answer.
Mm. Yeah.
Because if you think this is happening in the wild, why? What's the advantage
of laying eggs and using your energy? None. Yeah.
That's right. You've just given away a year's worth of food for nothing.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense ecologically. And you know, there's a whole heap of those things that you go, wow, what? If we had a kid that's keen enough to run around the escarpment with transmitters,
where the hell is Lucas? Somebody give me Lucas.
We have an intern. His name is Lucas.
We'll send him.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He just got his master's. Yeah.
Keith and I talked about this sort of stuff for Bowlands as well, you know, having that sort of ability to put transmitters in a whole heap of these species that we know bugger all about other than what we've got in captivity. And you know, the beauty of the project that I've got that I see is like that girl doing honours on the Kalia, I've started what can be built on.
We know
enough about reproductive biology, what they're prepared to eat in captivity, how they stress, how they interact in captivity to say, well, we know enough about it to put some transmitters in some and follow them around. And the beauty, if you could do that, is the traditional owners would support that like you wouldn't believe. You know, they'd want to know. They'd be fascinated by it. So, yeah, anyway.
That's cool.
Get your brain.
How many times have you bred them?
22.
Jesus.
Oh, wow.
Kind of got the hang of it.
Yeah,
not me. I didn't do anything. I just go, here, guys, you do it.
That's what I say every time.
I just bring them wine and flowers.
Yeah, I lock them in a box together. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
We often talk about triggers that trigger pythons to breed in the wild, or just breed in general, not just in the wild. whether it's food cycling, temperature cycling, humidity, fronts coming in. Do you have any thoughts on what is the what's the trigger for these guys?
A female?
A female. Okay. Easy enough.
I love the answers. Yeah. Eric's like, is it? No, there's a girl there.
It's a girl.
It's like, oh, yeah.
Well, if we go back to Peter Krause, right?
Yeah.
And Peter Krause used to mist them. As you, I think some of you guys do that for your green trees and a whole heap of stuff.
Yeah.
He used to mist them. And I'd go, why? Why do you do that, Peter? He goes, it initiates courtship and mating. And I go, really? Does it? Okay. Well, see, I struggle with that because if I'm an Arampelli and I'm living in Jabiru, my next rain is going to turn up in November.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm mating in July, which is the middle of the dry season and the coldest season and the season with less rain and there's no groundwater, why would I need a spray to mate?
Yeah.
There's nothing. And that's where I struggle as a scientist, because just because you're thinking of the logic of where they live doesn't always follow. In captivity, something is going to trigger him, and it obviously worked for Peter. You know, he lived on the tablelands in Queensland, and he'd go with his spray bottle, and they go, "Oh, now's the time." Let's go.
All he needed.
Yeah, that's right. And I go, "Wow, that's amazing." In general, there's nothing, and I put them together, and they go, "Oh yeah, there's a girl, beauty." And the only thing I would say is my mating pairs are in an aviary outside, and the temperature regime in Darwin is very similar to Jabiru. We're on about the same latitude and different longitudes, obviously, and that way, you know, the temperature in Darwin is a fraction cooler because of sea breezes, but pretty much the same all year round as Jabiru or Arnhem Land, and there is no rain. So I've never had to use any sort of cue like that other than the daylight hours, the normal cues that an animal would get in Jabiru.
Gotcha. Okay.
And you know, even if you keep them as pairs together, which I do in the aviary, they're never coiled up together throughout most of the year. And the female is always the boss. So the female dictates where she wants to be. She'll go, "Hey, mate, I want to be on that perch." And he'll go, "Fine, see ya, I'm gone." And she'll go down to it. And that changes as soon as they go into mating mode. And the male is about two-thirds the size of the female. The males are always smaller. So the female is the big, fat piggy, and the boy is the little lean piggy. And basically, when they start mating, he dictates where he's going to go. So he finally grows a pair. And basically they know their roles and she sometimes they're together all year round, and she'll go where she wants to for most of the year, and then he'll be up on when she comes in season, he'll be up on the top perch and he'll go, "Yeah, I'm here," and she'll go, "Oh, beauty, it's about time I got mated, I'm up with you."
Okay.
And then the flowers and the wine
and
comes
the wine out. And all. Yeah, okay, yeah.
yeah. Barry White doesn't seem to work though.
maybe Marvin Gaye is the better.
Yeah, everybody's got their taste. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I was going to say, don't give him a handgun, but we won't go there. the mating ritual. Can be really long term, you know. So he'll make when he knows she's in season, he'll start making a pest of himself. And like I say, she'll come when she's ready to mate, she'll come to him. But other times, he'll be all over her and she'll go, "No, get lost. And you know, you guys will have seen that in many pythons and boas, sure. Probably. Yeah. When she's ready, she just lifts her tail. It's like, yep. "Hello, warriors, you know, here I am." Yep. There you go.
Yeah.
And it's all over. So, and then you've got 12 to 48 hours of mating, and that's some stamina.
Yeah.
Is the courting typical? Like, is there spurring? Is there, you know, typical? Yeah.
The spurs on the male are definitely thicker and slightly longer. Girls of, you know, the girls of the same age, you've got long, thin spurs. Mm-hmm. I don't know why they got them. They don't need to use them. But, yeah, the boys will spur. And when you've got a male that weighs 990 grams, which is 1 kilogram, or what's that, 2.2 pounds, and he's sitting on a female that's 12 kilos, it's like a pimple on a pumpkin.
Yeah.
but they get the job done.
Job's done, yeah.
So, again, that was the smallest male. It was 990 grams. So you're looking at about 1.8 meters and about as thick as your middle finger.
Wow.
Yeah. Jesus.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy.
Seasonal feeders generally? Sorry, Keith.
No, that's all right. I was just going to ask how old the animal was that you brought that night that we took
to you. Oh, that I brought to you? Yeah, no, I think that was about a two-year-old.
You said it was a two-year-old.
Yeah.
That's what I wasn't looking at you or listening. I was looking at the snake, but I'm pretty sure that sunk in there somewhere. Yeah.
You should be my wife. She does the same thing. I wasn't looking at you.
I wasn't looking at you. Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. She's great. Luckily, she's working for us to earn a living.
Yeah. There's there you go. And an Owen Pelly Python. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's a two-year-old.
Look at how happy he was.
Yeah, I was just like, yeah.
Smile, damn it.
I don't think I was even touching the ground. I was just floating.
That was the same night we found the carpet as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because we're all looking on the ground, and you're like, it's up, you dummies. It's right there. Yeah, it's like, oh.
Yeah. Well, I took another young fellow to the park, you know, to where we were, and we roamed around there at the same time you guys were out here, and we found, I think we found a slaty grey. No, didn't find a carpet at all, and I was devastated because I really wanted to find one for the for this kid, and I went back the next night. There's one sitting right where you guys had seen the one that you saw.
Oh, wow,
I know it wasn't there the night before, so it just got there.
That's its spot, dude. All right, why not?
That's it.
That's amazing.
So are the Oompellys strongly seasonal feeders? I know, Keith, you've seen this with Jamaican boas, you know, in the same way that I told you. You know, there are times a year where they really want to eat, kind of regardless of size, right? Obviously, if you're talking about a pair that's going through a reproductive cycle, that'll influence it. But even in general, there are times a year they really want to eat, and then there are other times a year where they're really not that interested. Do you see that with the Oompellys as well?
The captive stuff, not so much. The adults, I do. But then, see, I'm really stingy. I've seen all these keyboard warriors that feed a fuzzy mouse to their 2-meter carpet python once a week. And I go, how does that work? And you go, let's go and have a look at what happens in the wild. And try and copy that to some degree, mainly because I'm lazy. and in the wild, food doesn't turn up every Friday at 6 o'clock in the evening. Food turns up once a week, and it might be a possum and three of her babies walking past. Mm-hmm. And if you don't take all four, you've missed what could be your only meal for the whole year. Mm-hmm. So you try and take as many as you possibly can because you never know when your next meal is going to be. And that's how pythons are wired, because they're sit-and-wait predators mostly. Water pythons are different. I think blackheads are a little bit different, but most of them are sit-and-wait predators that wait for food to come to them. And so there's no, everything is random. And random can be like 3 days in a row. Something turns up, so you eat it. Then it might be 3 months in a row where you get nothing. So I tend to do that. I'll go on the behavior of the animal. And olive pythons, I get, they're always hungry. It's like a teenager, you know. You can feed it now and 10 minutes later it's eating again. But most of them, they'll tell you when they're hungry. And you know, you see the pupils dilate and they'll sit in a head down position just waiting for something to walk under them. And that's what the Oompellys are doing in the big aviaries. They'll sit with their head down, pupils dilated, and they're saying, I'm hungry. Most of the time, if they're not hungry, they're just whatever. If they've just eaten, they just sit there looking happy, you know, doing what they do. So coming back to what you're saying, yes, there is a season, and we're in it now. You know, from the start of February to the end of March is that full on. I'll get, if I really want to, I'd get 10 or 15 kilos into the big girl. I try not to do that. Like I say, I'm pretty lazy, so I'll feed her 2 kilos 1 month and then 1 kilo the next month and then nothing the next month and then 3 kilos the month after that, because that's how they work. And if you're working with how the ecology of the animal works, I think you get a better animal.
Yeah.
Might be wrong. Yeah, it might be like,
I agree.
I'm wrong and everybody else is right. I don't know. But that's just how I go. And again, sometimes that comes back to what I can get to. You know, I told you I live where it's really hot. We can't get rats. So finding, you know, quails will breed gangbusters for part of the year and then not for the rest of it. And the guy that I get the quails off will go, haven't got any this week. I go, oh, bad luck, guys. You don't get any food. So,
sorry, guys. No go. That's
right. And you know, they don't starve to death in a month. And they probably don't starve to death in 6 months. But obviously somewhere in there they've got to get some sustenance. And so that's the way I've sort of always worked. Even when I was at Croc Cove, where I had, you know, you guys will remember Croc Cove's big display of Australian reptiles.
Right.
And even the pythons that I had there, I would make it so that their feeds were random. You know, elapids and colubrids would get fed regularly. But pythons I always made random because that's just how they work.
That makes sense.
Does that answer anything?
No, it does.
Absolutely. And that makes a ton of sense too.
And it makes more sense, especially in you know, U.S. captive herpetoculture, where feeding is done a lot. And, you know, there are a lot, I think one of the main problems people have with their animals is that they are overfed and that they're trying to force them to eat something that we assume they would want to eat, like a European rat. So less meals, and if it wants a bird, give it a bird. So,
and you've opened another can of worms, and it becomes a can of worms because we've been conditioned that rats are the answer. You know, I've got a snake. What's the answer? Rats. You know, you don't even have to say, I want to feed it something. It's just that's the answer.
Right.
And so we've been so conditioned to that. The propaganda is, if you're not feeding your python rats, you're a mongrel. You don't deserve to have your python. What are you doing? You know, when I was working when I had transmitters in all these snakes, the Stimson's pythons down in Ormiston Gorge, so there were about 15 stimos that had transmitters in them, I would look at, you know, their feces, and I'd look at a whole heap of things, stomach contents and stuff like that. And those stimos were eating 32 different types of prey. 32.
Wow.
So the answer isn't just rats, is it?
No. Wow. Hell no. No.
You know, there were rats in their diet, you know, a couple of different rock rats and rat rats. But in terms of just their diet, it was so varied. It was almost like a human. You would say 32 different types of prey is huge.
That's insane.
From geckos to a couple of different types of frogs to different finches to whatever, you know, antechinus and rats and stuff like that. And you go, well, we know a varied diet is good. So are we getting the most out of our pythons when the answer is rats?
I don't think so.
That's what I was just going to ask you. If that plays into their health overall. Right.
Micro and macronutrients the varied diet and all that has to, you would presume, right? Our assumption would be that that's helpful. And the other thing too, right, in terms of overfeeding, is the general consensus is that if you have the fat bodies lining, you know, the interior of the body cavity, that's going to limit the ability for them to ovulate properly. They can't get large enough to ovulate properly if the body cavity
is full
of fat bodies.
Yeah. That's right. You see that a lot. So, the converse of that is, how do you convince people that rats don't, you know, it could be rats plus or rats squared or something, you know?
I feel like we're slowly starting to gain ground with that kind of stuff, because with Morelia, carp pythons, rough scale pythons, things like that, I have found that if it is a reluctant feeder, that if you show it a baby button quail, a bird the size of a fuzzy, it goes insane. Like, all of a sudden, it's that you flip that switch, and it's that over assist feeding, force feeding, things like that, kind of making it easier. So we're kind of gaining some ground, because I hear more and more that people have had better experiences with that. They don't have to grip up their snake and shove something down it. And people are starting to do a little bit more of a varied diet.
Well, that's good. That's good. Just got to get that through to the keyboard warriors.
We'll keep trying. Maybe in 5 years we'll gain a little bit of ground.
I'm sure you guys get it tenfold, but over here it's become really bad, where you've got someone that got their first pet blue tongue, and all of a sudden they've been in the hobby for all of about 3 weeks. And they're giving advice on a recalcitrant carpet python that's got stomatitis or something like that.
My favorite is to watch people try to dictate blood python and or short tail talk to Keith McPeak. And it's like, you have that because of, I don't really, you're going to argue this? Like, yeah, it's like, all right, fine. Yeah, whatever. I like to watch those. Those are hilarious.
And Keith, do you answer back, though? Because no. I just don't even go there. I just go, yeah, okay, you must be right, mate.
I try to be very diplomatic.
you're more passive than me because my answers wouldn't be very polite. And then I get trolled and attacked anyway. So you just go, well, what's the point?
It'd be like somebody saying you don't know what you're doing about my – I have an Owen Pelly Python. You don't know what you're talking about. It's like, wait, you – have never mind. So at certain points, you just got to let it go.
Yeah, for sure. On that, I wish I could get to the point where more people could have this animal. Unfortunately, New South Wales not allowed to have it. Tasmania, Victoria, you know, it's a really Western Australia. It's a really restricted market, and I can't get them overseas. And you say, send them to the US. I would love them to be all over the place because the more people that have them, the more that understand that they're a really special animal and also have that connection with the traditional owners that I work with. And, you know, you don't have to do welcome to country or acknowledge anything, but knowing where it's come from is really important. And
it's huge.
And unfortunately, I've done as much as I can possibly do. I'm at wit's end because... Yeah. We had a research project that was going to go ahead out of Europe, and they wanted 15 pair, and that would have been fantastic because it would get it over there,
and then it would eventually do its thing. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. It was not for commercial purposes. It was a research project. I was fine with that. We went through our Minister for the Environment in Australia, a lady called Tanya Plibersek, and. We got to the point where they agreed, the department agreed that this was a good project. It was looking at genetic bottlenecks. It was looking at decline in a species when you get those genetic bottlenecks. And they agreed that it was a good project. It was through two different universities in Europe. And they sent back the last correspondence, said, can you fix these couple of things and we'll okay it. Well, we fixed those within a week, sent it back, and you'd expect them to go, wouldn't you? You'd expect that this university, a couple of unis in Europe would have them. The department never got back to us. We sent them half a dozen letters, well, probably not that many, probably four letters. We've contacted them in a number of different ways, and they refused to answer. But I can tell you that if... I hadn't have been Gavin, if I had have been the Territory Wildlife Park or the Australian Reptile Park or Taronga Zoo that had bred them and negotiated with this, they would have been gone like that. They would have gone to Europe. They would be more widely spread than they are now. So essentially what we're looking at is politics, the politics of our natural history. They'd rather this animal go extinct than us know how to protect from bottlenecks in genetics. It gets really frustrating, and you can probably hear the disappointment in my voice because it shouldn't be like this. It should not be like this. And to some degree, you guys are very lucky in that if you Keith's been working with bowlers for a long time, and now you've got other things that are of equal importance that we know enough about to be able to protect them in the wild. If we can't protect what we've got left, then the only way you're going to see them is in a box.
Yeah.
Gavin, I can tell you that your work, though, has inspired a lot of people. Like most of us on this show right now will be able to have an Owen Pelly in our lifetime. But yet we travel over there to experience their habitat, and we're captivated by the artwork that we see on the walls in their environment. And we want to experience as much about that animal as we can, knowing that we're never going to own one in captivity. Mm-hmm. Like we're just fascinated by it. And I want to thank you because a lot of that is because of the work that you've done on this. Well,
thanks, Keith.
100%.
Yeah. I mean,
sorry.
No, no. So the second they hit the shores, though, I'm jumping on it. If they get here, if they ever get here, I'm
you
not
may
even
swim
hesitating.
To Europe to oh, get one.
Yeah,
if
some I don't care. I'm, yeah.
Well, let me just put the cat amongst the pigeons a little bit.
Okay.
I would hope that they get to the US at some stage in my lifetime, in our lifetime. If that doesn't happen, well, there's not much I can do about that. But because I've bred as many as I can breed for the Australian market, mm-hmm. I'm at a point where I'm breeding so many each year that unless I drop them to stupid numbers like you guys do corn snakes, which I won't do.
Thank God.
And I don't keep any goannas anymore, and most people will know what that means. Mm-hmm. What do I do with the offspring that I breed? So I went back to the traditional owners, Freddie Hunter and Yvonne, and I said, I'd like to put some of these back on your country. I can't put the adults back. I'm not allowed to because of, you know, health concerns and a whole heap of stuff like that. But I can put babies back because Parks and Wildlife have agreed that essentially the youngsters are sterile, so we can start putting them back. So I'm trying to make it so that the traditional owners actually get a little bit of income by having very wealthy jet-setting tourists from the US come and help put some animals back into the wild.
So fantastic.
Go up into that amazing country, which is 80 kilometers from the nearest track. Have a think about that. 80 kilometers from the nearest track. That's not a road, that's a track.
Yeah.
And you can only get there by helicopter. So and take some of the babies to some of the caves where we know Owen Pelly were, maybe they still are, and release some of these babies up there. And do that over the next, you know, 5, 6, whatever years that I can breed them, and I think that way, you know, you get to interact with the traditional owners. You get to see how important they are to them, but they also get to see how important you are and feel attached to this particular python, even if you don't have it. You know? This year we'll be releasing 12. There'll be 4 going up into Freddie's country and 8 going to Yvonne's country. Yvonne's country is near Gumbalanya, Owen Pelly Township. So you can do that in the dry season, drive across Cales Crossing, don't get eaten by crocodiles, and go and see them. We haven't set all this up yet, but I'm just putting it out there that, you know, if that's of interest, please put your hand up or let me know or whatever.
How many hands do we got to do? Yeah.
Well, only 2 of us on here are going to be coming to see you in October, Owen.
I know. Probably this year's are essentially spoken for. It will be just a soft release this year just with the traditional owners and me, just to see how it goes and what works and what doesn't. Because the other thing that it's really hard to explain that they are really private people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it'd be like me saying, I'm going to go into your house and I want to see everything in your house, but you're not allowed to be there. It's a tough gig. You know, you know that, oh, hang on, why are you going to my house? Well, their country's the same as that. They'd like you to be there, but they also need to know that you go there with respect for them and respect for their country. And to do that, they need to make sure that there's just a few things that you've got to do when you go there. It's not like you've got to get a tattoo like you, Keith, or anything. There's nothing that dramatic. It's just being respectful of who they are and where we're going. That's all. So
that's awesome, and
you do that when you go into court and things like that. Anyway, you know, you bow to his honor or whatever, her honor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think they would make a Keith tattoo?
What?
Yeah. What do you think they would? Would they approve of Keith's Owen Pelly tattoo?
Oh, absolutely.
What do you think they'd make of it?
Oh, yeah. they would love that. That shows respect. And Keith, I'm not doing it.
I'm doing it. I'll do it. I got room on my back still. It's fine.
Yeah. I need one.
Yep.
I think Darren's going to do the same, isn't he?
Yeah.
Darren said he was going to do the same thing. Man, I'm a complete chicken.
We're coming. We're almost at 2 hours. I don't know if there's anything else you guys wanted to hit on, but I want to make sure that we cover his
book. The book. Yeah, yeah, the book.
So, okay.
The book we can't get that we're being taunted with right now. Yeah.
Well, some of us are going to Australia, so there's a possibility to fly home with one.
Oh, there we go. Never mind. I love you, Keith. Yeah, bring the books home.
Oh, I didn't even think about that.
I didn't think about that. Like, just wait till October. Oh,
Eric, you didn't think about that. It was the first thing that popped in my head.
I wanted Keith to bring me home a croc skull, but yeah, we can do that too. It's fine. I got ideas.
Keith, you're a genius, Keith.
God, this is why we keep you around.
I just have to keep finding you these Owen Belly, whether it's in book form or the actual snake.
Snake or book, either one.
We prefer the snake, but if it's a book, it's a book.
I'll take a book.
As long as it's a book. Tell us about your book and did you actually want to write a book when you started this whole project back at the beginning?
When some things started happening that were, that I mentioned that political process and how the powers that be instantly said no without even looking at what the question was. I did want to write a book, but it was more scathing of the process than anything else. In a way, I'm more proud to write about what I know about this animal in captivity because I know it will help other people when they do get them, when they have got them. And if you just say, here's a python breeding manual, go and do it, you come unstuck because they are different. And maybe you'll figure it out, maybe you won't, but this takes a lot of that thinking out of it. You know, they really will test you at times. In the preface, I say this is the thinking person's python that never does anything quickly. Now, if you know someone, a kid on ADHD that lives on raspberry cordial, you know they bounce off walls and probably getting a Taipan is better for them because their activity level is about that. But if you deal with sloths or, koalas or something that lives the life on the slow lane, then this is the python for you because they really will test you and it's all in slow motion. I mean, I saw some of these, not just the wild caught ones, but the captive bred ones take 3 hours of sniffing a quail before they'll decide they want to eat it. Now, I don't know about you, but I get a little bit impatient when something takes 3 hours to eat, especially when I want to go out or something. And so you start saying, come on, eat. You mother, eat it. Mm-hmm. And the more you want it to happen, the less it does. So with everything you do with this snake, you just got to take your time. It's not an olive python. It won't dive out of the cage and take your hand as well as the rat. It'll just go, is that what you're offering me? Oh, I think I ate that last week. Leave it with me, and I'll get back to you. That's just how they are. So if you can deal with that, then you get on nicely. I've been a little bit impatient at times, especially when you've got. At the moment, I think I've got 89 here.
89. Jeez.
Yeah. It's a bit too many, but that's by the by. No, it's not. I worked out that I've seen more Owen Pellies than everybody else put together. Admittedly, that's most of the ones that are bred, but
still.
Anyway, interesting snake. I'm looking forward to you guys getting out here. That'd be great. And Keith and I are going fishing, so you'll have to go herping one day.
Yeah, I was telling Eric that you and I have another passion that we share in fishing, and you actually invented quick fix for the rods, right?
Yeah.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
Let's plug books here, Keith. Not
so Keith, come on.
Gotta plug the right thing.
Yeah.
The good thing is the Quick Fix Rod Guide is the website that the book's on.
Oh, there you go.
No, I've done that sort of strategically because I'm not a very good salesperson. In fact, I'm the worst salesperson in the world. I've tried to put all my inventions on the one line where you can buy it. So if you go to Quick Fix Rod Guide, you go, oh, what else has he done? Look at that. He's invented these things that fix fishing rods. Oh, and he's done a book for kids. And he's done some art frames. Wow, they look neat. So with a bit of luck, there'll be some pretty smart and intelligent people over in the US that go, I better have one of each.
Take my money.
Yeah, keep trying. Love it.
Eric doesn't even fish and he's going to buy it.
Yeah.
Just in case I ever need another hobby.
I am getting older.
It's a great Christmas present for people that do fish.
Okay, that's good to know.
Very good.
So we're just doing Australian orders for the book currently, and then you're going to open up for international later on.
When I actually have a physical book, and like I say, this is the manuscript that I've got a few edits to do. It's finished, but there's probably about 6 hours work that the lady will have to then insert into what the document that she's done as the book. Mm-hmm. It'll be out in probably a month and a half, I guess, so 6 weeks. Then I'll know the weight of the book because at the moment I want to do it in hardcover, but whether I can afford to do it in hardcover and what the cost of shipping and stuff like that changes, I'll have to figure it out. But that's my game plan. I'd like to do that, but until I know what the weight of the book is, it makes it really hard because shipping is all on weight.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I think I seem to like the idea more and more of just Keith needs to bring an extra bag in October and put as many books as he can in there. It's fine. So I think we'll figure it out. We'll get there. So.
Oh, very good.
Owen, I already bought your book, Owen.
I know.
Oh.
Yeah, how many copies of the Complete Carpet Python do you have, sir?
Eric, I still don't know that I ever got that new one from Scott and Ty.
Oh.
It's right there on my shelf.
You
just have to remember tell me.
You have to get to his house and steal
things.
An old
man now.
Yeah, that's how I do it.
You got to remind me of
things. I just walk in and take things. It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay.
This has been fabulous, Evan.
Yeah,
this has been awesome. It's been a long time coming, and I've been completely happy with where we were going. Like, it's exactly what I expected, and I loved every second. So.
Well, the poor students that are listening here are going, oh, thank God I didn't get that question.
They'll be fine.
The one good thing about the book is that our second highest audience is Australia. So
there you go. Yeah.
And that's what Darren said to me. I thought Darren would have been on here too because he's very heavily involved with his pelis and is a very good at observing stuff as well. And he's set his up better than almost anyone I've ever seen. He's just done a brilliant job.
Yeah.
Whereas mine's essentially a factory, and my wife doesn't like snakes in the house, even though I've got about 70 here. so I can't set them up as Darren does as display animals. I'd really like to, but I also like staying married. So let's not get too carried away.
Yeah.
So. If anyone were going to ask, how do you set them up? Darren or Matt Somerville or the Australian Control Park, they are brilliant at doing this, and I'd always steer you towards them.
Yeah, that's Darren's setup.
He's the one that hooked this up because he sent me some pictures, and then he contacted you, Gavin, and here we are. So
yeah.
I'm glad it worked out.
That's
awesome. I love it.
So where what's the website again to where
for the book
for the book and the fishing rod stuff and
KFRG at KFRG.au, sorry.
Okay.
Actually, see if you can just hone in on that. The QR code.
You just hold on one sec. You're going to pop that up as large. There you go. So there's a QR code.
That'll take you straight to the book.
Okay.
Awesome.
Beautiful.
Cool.
Very good.
I love it.
And that's exactly what I'll be spruiking at the expo on Saturday and Sunday. You want the book? Scan the QR code. You got it.
There you go. There it is. You got it.
Very good.
Let's go back to this. There we go.
There you go.
Right. I don't know. Anything else you guys have in closing, or
anybody have anything they need to throw out there? Keith, did you write a book that we don't know about yet?
He's working on it.
That's right.
Pushing it.
Good. It's gonna be a pop-up book. You know, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
So, all right. I got nothing, Eric. If you got nothing, we just probably close it out.
All right.
Thanks, Gavin, for coming on and talking with us. Thank you to Master Stone, who's, you know, always around when we need him. And, of course, Keith McPeak, who is tempting me with as many boa species as I am with him with my various python species. So there we go. Thanks, guys. This has been a great show. And I kind of want to do a second round of this later on for some reason. We'll figure it out.
In the field.
Do it.
Yeah.
Let's do it in Kakadu.
There you go. There you go. In Kakadu.
Looking forward to seeing you, Gavin.
Yeah.
You guys too. Yep.
That's awesome.
Very good.